Order copies of today's program, Sarah Lee Whitson on Human Rights and Democracy in the Middle East, and for Edward Said's books, The Pen and the Sword, and Culture and Resistance, just give us a call, 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or go online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us at 1-800-444-1977. Sergio Atala recorded the program. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.
KBOO Portland.
This is Joseph Galvan. I'm your host for Art Focus. KBOO Community Radio is only possible with your support, so join the party and contribute at kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to this number, 44321. That's kboo.fm/give. Or you can just text KBOO to the number 44321. Thanks a lot.
Andy Warhol looks a scream. Had him on my wall. Andy Warhol, silver screen. Can't tell them apart at all.
KBOO.
Radio in San Francisco, this is Flashpoints. I'm Dennis Bernstein. Today on the show, the immigration nightmare unfolding at the U.S.-Mexico border grows more violent and deadly by the hour. Also, the January 6th Select Committee makes a bit of history, recommends Trump for criminal prosecution. And we'll take a look at what inflation and the ups and downs of the stock market really means to working people in real terms that maybe we can understand. All this coming up straight ahead on Flashpoint. Stay tuned. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. Later on in this broadcast, we'll play a little bit of the sound from today's hearing. I'm sure you have heard by now that the Select Committee has, in fact, recommended that Trump and a few others be prosecuted by the Justice Department. But maybe when the special prosecutor decides to move back to the continental United States, we'll see a little bit more action. It is worrisome to watch how that doesn't unfold. Anyway, we're going to start by taking a look at the economy, inflation. What are all these things that are going on now? The sort of the crashing of the crypto land scheme. What does all this mean to us, everyday folks trying to get by? Joining us to talk about this is Mr. James Henry. And Mr. Henry's books include The Blood Banker's Tales from the Global Underground Economy and The Pirate Bankers. He is a Global Justice Fellow at Yale, a Senior Fellow at the Columbia University Center for Sustainable Investment, and he's formerly the Chief Economist of McKinsey & Company. Okay. Well, welcome back to Flashpoints, James Henry. Good to have you back.
Good to be with you. And the economy is a challenge right now. Nobody knows what's going to happen, but we could talk about it.
Well. Let's see if we can just help us get a little bit more literate about what's happening to us or not happening to us. We hear about inflation all the time. Most of the people, I do this. I stop and I ask people, random people. You know, I'm a journalist. Hey, what do you think the reason is that inflation is so dangerous? Silence. We don't know. But we're hearing about it all the time.
Yeah, exactly. I think the Federal Reserve has announced that we need to have an absolute 2% target for inflation, and that they're struggling to get it down from where it is right now, which is somewhere around 7%. You know, there's a number of different inflation measures, and depending on who you ask, but everybody agrees that it's been, declining for the last few months, but it peaked sometime in the middle of the summer around 9%. But you know what your inflation rate is really depends on who you are. So people who are consuming a lot of gasoline, they're seeing higher rates back in the summer, and now the rates have fallen dramatically. People who are worried about healthcare or in the rental market, they're seeing vastly different inflation rates, and folks who have to buy food and are dependent on the grocery stores or have seen especially high rates this month. It was up 10%. So it really does depend in this society on exactly who you are, like most things do. And so that's kind of part of the inequality of inflation. It imposes different costs on a lot of different folks, and it's very hard to summarize.
What is it? What is inflation?
Well, the standard economic definition starts with a basket of goods, and we kind of have to agree on what is that essential basket of goods. But, you know, you go around and you do surveys of people, and you figure out what, on average, people are consuming. They're going to be consuming commodities, food, and, beverages, and they're going to be consuming clothing, and so you get, then there's going to be services like rents and healthcare. And some of those are hard to measure exactly. But at the end of the day, you end up having a list that's kind of common for the average person. This is the concept. And then you track that over time and see how much that average basket costs relative to the baseline when you started out. Measuring inflation is an art form. It isn't perfect by any means, but the Department of Labor and Department of Commerce have been coming up with these measures for decades. The most you can say about them is that they're roughly consistent over time. So we can say that we may not know whether the absolute rate of inflation is right, but it's kind of relative to last month or previous times. We can have a pretty good sense of whether it's headed up or down. We've had, during the 20th century, we had a number of countries that completely lost control of their inflation rates. Germany is during Weimar Germany was probably the best example. And so we know the extreme consequences on societies of letting inflation go. But when you're talking about the difference between a 2% or a 3% or a 5% rate of inflation and the actual social cost of that, it's much less clear to many economists that, the Federal Reserve is kind of justified in imposing civil war surgery on the whole society just to get the inflation rate down. They're mainly concerned about not losing credibility, and since the value of the dollar depends on credibility of the Fed, and the world financial community looks to the Fed to sort of lead the way on fighting inflation, and the Fed is very much concerned about whether it's taken seriously. It hasn't done a very good job in this last 2-year period of getting out in front of this problem early and dealing with it in advance. And so it's had to sort of revise, make it up as it goes along. And frankly, as the Fed chair said just this week, we don't really know whether we're going to have a recession or not next year. You know, so there have been all kinds of forecasters like Jamie Dimon of J.P. Morgan declare they're absolutely headed for a deep recession, which is defined by, at least a couple quarters of negative growth. And we haven't had that for quite a while. So, you know, this is a concern that's on the minds of many people in the financial services community, as well as ordinary Americans.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with economist James Henry. And, well, we've been talking about inflation, still trying to get a hold on that. And we sort of need a deck of trading cards of key economic terms so that us everyday folks can get a quick translation. But, right. You know, it is interesting that the language and not understanding the language of the economy and of economics really puts us at a disadvantage in terms of knowing what's happening. That's, of course, why we come to you, Jim. So, go on. I'm sorry. Please.
No, I was going to say, there are some important aspects of the general inflation story to emphasize. First of all, the general rate of inflation, kind of this average across all these, this whole basket full of goods and services, is very much different from, let's say, what's happening to real wages or, you know, the real cost of milk or any particular sector. So that's a more specific issue, and it usually has to do with, specific supply side issues, specific demand issues in those sectors, as opposed to the general rate of inflation, which is dependent on the Federal Reserve's manipulation of the money supply. So that's an important distinction for people to understand, the difference between the average rate of inflation over all the commodities that they're purchasing and the specific rate of inflation. The other key thing to realize here is that this is very much a distributional issue. You have labor and management sort of arguing about the distribution of income from corporate profits, which have been at a very high level, set record levels the first part of this year, and in the United States. Other countries, not nearly as well. I mean, China's had a lot of problems this year with corporate profits, but basically you have labor going to the bargaining table where there is a bargaining table and saying, look, productivity growth has been really strong in the U.S. economy since 2019, and we're not really keeping up with the growth rate of inflation. And so real wages are declining even though productivity is growing. So that's another key aspect of the inflation story. The Federal Reserve tends to sort of go after accelerating rates of inflation independent of this distributional question. And that's in the background, as every union member can tell you.
Jim, let's talk a little bit about how things like what happened recently with Sam Bankman-Fried, the sort of the crypto criminal, how does that kind of huge ripoff that sends reverberation through certain aspects of the economic community, do we all end up paying a price for that kind of economics, voodoo economics, or whatever you want to call it?
Well, I think there's several concerns that I have there. First of all, Bankman was basically printing money and then buying a lot of political power. He was, by all accounts, if not the largest, certainly one of the top 10 political contributors to Congress this year, in this election year. Gave more than $90 million. Probably when you add everything up, we don't have the numbers, but it's more than $100 million, to most of which went to Democrats. And so, you know, he was trying to buy influence for basically his industry, which was the crypto industry. And part of the story was to try to minimize the amount of regulation that goes on from the Federal Reserve and also from the SEC and other Washington regulators, U.S. Treasury. The phenomenal story about the sort of insider connections between, you know, some of the members of the bureaucracy in Washington and Bankman and his team is phenomenal. You know, they're all kind of very close to people at MIT and Stanford, and they all sort of swim in the same water. And then there's all this political capital. So I think one concern here is about what this implies for the nature of unlimited political power being sold to, you know, very wealthy people. Bankman is kind of an instant billionaire, but that's just a special case of a general problem. What we have is that political power can be quickly acquired by people who just happen to have money, not because of, as we've seen in Bankman's case, not because they're creating anything real, but they were able, in fact, to avoid regulation. So the degree to which his activities presented what we call a systemic risk to the overall economy, like, you know, the banks did back in 2008, is a sort of different story. But I think there's a general problem that we're facing, which is that there's a whole category of Bankman-like investment funds and investment enterprises. He was actually a crypto exchange, and he gathered in a lot of, you know, deposits from people and sent him to his own hedge fund, and the money disappeared. But there's a whole category of investment funds that are basically somewhat similar in terms of being pyramid schemes. You know, the so-called investment funds, the OEFs, as the IMF describes them, now manage about $41 trillion of money in the world economy. And they have invested in lots of illiquid assets. And so there's this concern that, you know, if there was a run on these assets, we'd have mini Bankman-type stories. And so some of the largest funds involved, like BlackRock and, you know, the some of these people are managing U.S. pension funds, advising them on what they should be advising, what they should invest in. We saw a couple pension funds actually investing in the Bankman enterprise. And, you know, the Louisiana pension fund and the Ottawa pension funds thought they would capitalize on the crypto boom, and they lost their shirts. So, you know, this is a general, I mean, it's not what we call a macroeconomic concern necessarily, unless there's some systemic risk that would involve taking down a lot of different institutions. But when I looked under the covers here at Bankman's operations, he had a lot of investors from Wall Street and from Silicon Valley who had drunk the Kool-Aid with a surprising lack. I mean, Sequoia, one of the biggest venture capital firms, BlackRock, these folks had given him money. You know, there's a concern that if they're that careless in terms of, you know, these are major advisors and venture firms. If they're that careless with their investors' money, what else are they doing wrong? And so that's a general concern. I do hope that there's a thorough investigation of Bankman. But as we've seen, you know, he's bought so much political clout in Washington that it may not happen.
Let me ask you this: How somebody like me that maybe makes $50,000 or $60,000 a year, how am I going to be using cryptocurrency? Why would I want to be interested in this thing, or is this just for a select group of people who will sooner or later figure out a way to use it to extract what's left of the resources and money in the middle and working class?
I really struggle to see the value of crypto as a means of payment. I mean, we already have currency. We have any number of, you know, checking systems. We have credit cards and debit cards. And so the idea that people really need crypto in order to do anything but, you know, conceal their taxable income is, you know, is really hard to see. You can't buy anything with crypto. Bitcoin, you know, is not something you can take down to the drugstore and buy. There were some efforts to make it more of a means of payment, but ultimately it came down to sort of a Ponzi scheme, which people are holding the currency in the expectation that someone else will be willing to pay them for it at the end of the day. And that's, you know, that's just the opposite of having a secure store of value and, you know, something that people want to use for a means of savings. I mean, if I buy the farm, I can at least grow crops on it. But if I buy the cryptocurrency and stick it on my computer someday, it has absolutely no value right now, not even as a means of payment. Most retailers can't accept it. And it was strictly, I think it's almost a pure form of the tulip craze that we saw in the Netherlands. But, you know, it has a lot of, there are a lot of, there's a whole army of people in Silicon Valley because it's technical, it has, you know, geeky attributes to it. It, you know, it's sort of hard to explain, just has that sort of esoteric quality that you know, sort of computer types sometimes fall in love with. And it also plays to sort of so-called libertarian instincts. You know, people who are sort of thinking we can abolish governments and go back to having, you know, means of payment that are just based on the open registers that don't require banks or regulation. And they're just, you know, sort of self-enforcing systems. I think that's not only theoretically preposterous for a lot of good, solid economic theory reasons, but it's also just empirically false. We've had 1,000 years of capitalist history that's shown what happens when you don't have financial mechanisms that are basically regulated by somebody. And you know, the whole history of the United States is replete with banking crises. You know, crypto is in a way just another category of asset that has no regulatory background. It's like the banks in the 1830s, the people, sort of wildcat banking set up all of the United States without any regulation. And lo and behold, people found that they were issuing fraudulent loans and their deposits disappeared. You know, there was no one looking over the shoulder of these bankers. Right. So, you know, right. I mean, it's kind of a fool's errand. So people are willing to put money into these, you know, sort of valueless properties. I mean, nobody can really prevent fools and their money from being separated.
Well, and the other problem we have here, as witnessed by the fact that for the first time in history, today the Congress has recommended that the former president be indicted by the Justice Department, be tried for an attempted insurrection. But you mentioned also that Mr. big-time crypto guy, Sam, mm-hmm. Bought a lot of Democrats. What do you think the role is of dark and dirty money, say, in bringing us a Donald Trump? You think we would have had Trump if there wasn't so much dark money and the ability to maneuver money various illegal ways that rich people get away with all the time?
Yeah, but I think it starts a lot earlier than most people are aware of. And I've written about this, and you can Google the articles I wrote from American Interest on the origins of Trump's recovery in the early 2000s. But frankly, you know, he had 6 bankruptcies in the 1990s, and no bank would finance him except for Deutsche Bank, which is very close to the Russians. And most of his other financing also came from offshore sources. And so his real recovery from 2000 to 2012 was heavily dependent on a lot of crooks that he was dealing with offshore. Now, this is something that Mueller investigation never really looked at. But, you know, we had a guy named Ribolovlov who bought Trump's Miami house in 2000 2008 for about $40 million more than Trump had paid for it. And coincidentally, Donald Trump was at that point just about ready to go bankrupt again. So at a very critical time, this Russian oligarch comes out of the blue and buys his house. And, you know, he has a lot of funny money that poured into his empire. Rudy Giuliani was partnering with one of Trump's key advisors and laundering money for Kazakhstan. I mean, it just goes on and on. But none of this stuff was really investigated. If you roll forward now, you see dark money pouring into the financing of the Stop the Steal. We've counted at least $3 million that went into bringing those folks together. Some of it we know was due to some entrepreneurs, like the owner of a public supermarket chain. But we just don't know about where the rest of it come. It wasn't free to bring all the Proud Boys to Washington. They had about 2,000 people in Washington, 900 of them been charged with insurrection. And so, you know, I was hoping that this investigation, which concluded today with the recommendation that, you know, four charges against Donald Trump personally, would have gotten into all these other folks who are helping to finance this thing, because it wasn't free. And it ended up having a very close call. I mean, it was very close to having some of our elected representatives actually killed in Washington that day. So, you know, I think there's a whole lot more investigation. Unfortunately, we're not going to have that because the new Congress is probably going to drop this unless the Justice Department continues it. Maybe the Justice Department will get into some of the dark money issues.
Do you think anybody can make a good case at this point? How many times have you heard no man, usually it's no man is above the law. But what kid, what teenager, what 12, 15-year-old will believe that today when they see that the former president of the United States can assassinate cops, attempt to overthrow the government, applaud for a potential hanging of his own vice president, and still run for president? Is no man above the law? I mean, isn't this a big problem at the core of our society? Yeah, I mean, you're somebody who's studied finances six different ways and really help translate this stuff for the people, but we're in bad shape here. This hasn't changed much, has it?
Well, I think the good news is that something like 60% of the American people now hold Trump responsible for what went on that day, which was absolutely shameful and unprecedented in our nation's history.
But where's the Justice Department and the no man's above the law, Jim?
Well, the Justice Department, I think, has been taking its own sweet time with this kind of prosecution, and I would have hoped that they would have done something by now. But I think they have a kind of an inborn reluctance to indict a former president. And, you know, they're worried about the longer-term effects of that. That's a tough decision. But, yes, you're asking the right question. There is a level of impunity for powerful people and institutions in this country. Last month, I went to the Department of Labor, and they held hearings on the advisory system for pension funds. And the question was, should the Department of Labor be able to kick an institution out that has been serially convicted of financial crimes from advising U.S. public pension funds? I would have thought the answer was yes. But I found that I had all these experts who were doing this for nothing, is testifying about how institutions like Credit Suisse and HSBC and UBS and other major institutions that were advising U.S. funds as qualified pension asset managers had also been convicted all over the planet for, you know, all kinds of chicanery.
I listened to that. We're running out of time. I'm sorry, but I listened to that. You invited me to listen to that hearing, and I found it extraordinary that really the government of the United States is essentially impotent, or it seems as though, to really restrain these international corporate criminals. They are simply, the regulators never seem to be up to it. They're tremoring, shaking in the corners. And these corporations just move on.
Well, we were up against at least 50 hired shills from the other side, including the American banking industry.
I know.
We need to do more focused sort of analysis of what's going on with financial institutions. But they have an enormous amount of political clout. You know, they contributed in this election cycle as much as Bankman-Fried did. So at least $100 million
right.
to top pension fund advisors to Congress. So, this is an ongoing story.
All right. Listen, really appreciate it. We've been speaking with James Henry. His books include The Blood Bankers, Tales from the Global Underground Economy and The Pirate Bankers. He's a Global Justice Fellow at Yale, a senior fellow at the Columbia University Center for Sustainable Investment, and a former chief economist of McKinsey and Company. Boy, that was an interesting place to start. We'll talk to you soon, Jim. Thanks for taking the time out for us.
Good to be with you. Thank you.
Take care. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're going to take a short break, and we're going to talk about what is going on at the border. Title 42 is still there, and the suffering is immense. Stay with us. Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. We are live today in Los Angeles and San Francisco, and we are happy to have you along. We're also happy to be able to welcome back to these airwaves somebody who's been really on the front lines of dealing with what's happening at the border, the immigration nightmare, so on and so forth. Nicole Phillips, she's the legal director at the Haitian Bridge Alliance. She'll be heading back to the border, I understand, again tomorrow. Nicole, welcome back to Flashpoints. Can you just sort of give us a general quick overview of what the situation is at the border? We always say it can't get worse, and it's getting worse. What does it look like these days? We're hearing that it's a bit of a hellish situation.
Good evening, Dennis. It's great to be back with you. Well, right now, El Paso seems to be the hot point. There, over the last week or so, there have been an estimated around 2,500 or so migrants that have been crossing each day. And they have been allowed to come into Texas through Juarez. And the El Paso mayor has just declared a state of emergency and is saying this doesn't bode well for if Title 42 ends. So what the big sort of panic that's happening across the entire border from Texas to California is whether or not this policy, Title 42, will end on December 21st. And as your listeners will recall, Title 42 is a policy that the Trump administration put in place in order to close the border in response ostensibly to the pandemic, the COVID pandemic. So they weren't allowing any asylum seekers to come in, period. And of course, the scientists all said that that was not needed, that actually wasn't keeping us safe at all. It was just a pretext, we concluded, to close the border. But the Biden administration continued on with that policy. But then about a year or so after they came into power, the administration took over, they decided to stop Title 42. That's gone back and forth between courts like a ping pong ball on whether or not it's going to stop. As you can imagine, the red states and the Republicans really want it to stop. Really want to continue Title 42, so they have a reason to close the border. And a lot of the Dems and certainly the immigrant advocates want it to reopen. So right now we don't know what's going to happen on 21st. It's up before SCOTUS. And it's up, they'll have the final word on what to do. But all of this confusion has trickled down to the border, where people like the lawyers, don't know what's going to happen on the 21st of December, and they don't know whether they should hurry and try and get across, or potentially without inspection, or whether they should wait and see what kind of a program is rolled out by the Biden administration to replace Title 42 if it is lifted. It's getting cold. And so El Paso, for example, is supposed to be 22 degrees in the next few days at night. And so people are without shelter. They're sleeping in tents under tarps. They don't have blankets, sleeping bags, jackets for children. It's a really, really desperate situation all across the border as the temperatures freeze and as people just get more and more scared about what is their future of seeking safety into the United States.
So the situation at the who's coming now? It's Haitians. It's Venezuelans. Who and it's Cubans. Who's at the border now? And are they being treated the same way?
Well, we've seen less Venezuelans because of the program that Biden put into place several weeks back now, which was allowing humanitarian parole for Venezuelans who flew into the United States as opposed to crossing by the land border. So that has stopped a big flow of Venezuelans from coming through the border. We do see an uptick in Nicaraguans, as you mentioned, Cubans, certainly Haitians, Hondurans, and of course Mexicans and others. But that seems to be the bulk of who we're seeing now. People that are fleeing gangs, political violence, conflict, and some who are just, you know, looking for a better life in the United States. But with your question to Haitians, we are seeing an uptick in Haitians that are coming directly from Haiti. Haiti, as you know, is sort of a pressure cooker, unfortunately, of political instability and violence, and so people are being forced to flee and are coming as quickly as they can to try and rejoin family into the United States.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with Nicole Phillips. She's legal director for Haitian Bridge Alliance. And we're talking about the, this is, I guess, what is today, the 19th. So you're essentially, there really is no directive in directives. You say you're heading down to the border tomorrow, but you don't really know what the law is going to be, right? You don't, your advisement of folks who are arriving is, if you will, crippled by a lack of policy, of any policy.
That's right. Yeah, the lawyers, we are at a severe disadvantage because we don't know how to, what recommendations exactly to give our communities, our clients, but so are the humanitarian organizations on the ground. They don't know whether Title 42 will lift. They don't know if you're in San Diego or in El Paso. You don't know whether you're about to receive thousands of people passing through or not. And so it's been very hard to plan accordingly in order to be responsive to what will happen. But, you know, for the messaging, the reason we're going down is because of this confusion, and we want to make sure people can ask lawyers about what's happening, that they hear straight from us about what the different scenarios are of what could happen, and mostly just to sort of warn people not to cross outside of ports of entry, not to cross without inspection, because we are anticipating that the Biden administration would likely detain people and potentially deport them. So we want them to avoid that. But it really requires a lot of faith that the administration will provide them with a fair opportunity to apply for asylum, to seek asylum, which no administration has really done for a number of years. And so it's difficult for migrants to have that trust.
I imagine that you've spent some time thinking about the kinds of things that would really need to happen when we're talking about humane immigration reform. What comes to mind for you? What are the kinds of things that need to happen? If you were an advisor to the president, what would you be telling him?
I really like that question, because I feel like we're so on the defensive to just open the border and allow people to seek asylum. But really, we shouldn't be there. Really, where we should be is answering the question you're asking, which is, what would it look like to have a fair, inclusive asylum system? And what that would encounter, what that would entail would be that people would be able to not be detained. We know you cannot fight your own asylum case when you're detained away from family. Most of the people I've spoken to, whether they're Haitian, from Cameroon, or from Venezuela, they've experienced significant trauma. Either the reason they fled their country was because of trauma, political violence, sexual, gender-based violence, and or the journey that they took to get to the border was filled with violence, persecution, and trauma. And so to put somebody in a jail with freezing temperatures and not allow them to really the full meaningful opportunity to seek asylum, to not even be able to find an attorney easily, and to not be able to be with their family and in the comfort of somebody's home. I think that puts them at a significant disadvantage. Further, in order to get out of that detention facility, we often make them pay a bond. And under the Trump administration, those bonds for Black immigrants were costing upwards of $40,000 and $50,000 to just get out of immigration detention, just for the right to seek asylum, which is already an internationally protected human right. But beyond that, they should have immigration judges that are fair, that know about their country, that understand Haiti and what people are going through in Haiti or Cameroon or Guatemala. They should have interpretation that's good, that is adequate and fair for them. There's a whole host of things that should be guarantees that seem obvious due process, but is not, unfortunately, afforded to most to most migrants. In fact, the asylum approval rating is extremely low. It seems like it would be high, but for example, for Haitians, about maybe 1 in 10. Who apply for asylum will win. And that's extraordinarily low considering what's going on in Haiti right now. And it just shows you the bias in the system and not being able to access attorneys and in not having a fair shake before an immigration judge.
You know, it's sort of a bit of terrible policy genius, the inventing of 42, because it's the best thing to come along since white bread when it comes to denying asylum. And it's just amazing the suffering that has caused, as you know, in the Haitian community is immense in terms of the ability for thousands of people to be flown back in the face of what everybody knows is an extraordinarily violent situation. So who did invent 42? I know it's the Trump administration. Is that who gave us that one? Do we know?
Yeah, I think it's probably going to be the strongest part of Stephen Miller's legacy. So Stephen Miller, who, as you know, was Trump's advisor in immigration from California, originally, he started devising this plan in 2018, 2019, before he even got word of the pandemic. And he was looking for other potential diseases to use with this Title 42 policy. And what it is it's a U.S. health and safety code, which on a very limited basis allows some processing for people who CBP identifies as potentially carrying a communicable disease. And so they were thinking perhaps smallpox or tuberculosis or something like
that.
Maybe measles. There may have been a small measles epidemic back then, you know, 2018, 19. Right. And he hit the mother load because all of a sudden the COVID pandemic came. So within weeks, the first thing the Trump administration did, the memos were already prepared. And so
they just had to fill in the blank. Fill in the blank.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, then that was my best question, I think. That is sort of criminal racism, right? But we know old Stevie Boy was top of the line when it came to sort of Nazi implementations.
And he's not stopping. Don't think for a second he's retired, because when I mentioned the court battles that are happening, sort of ping pong games with Title 42, he and his organization did file, of course, an amicus brief on behalf of the 22 conservative red states that have been trying to keep this policy in place to keep the border closed. So he's still throwing around his opinions and his weight.
Amazing. All right, listen, I really appreciate you joining us. I know you got a lot on your mind and a lot going on. We have been speaking with Nicole Phillips. She is legal director with the Haitian Bridge Alliance. They do very good work. There's always a lot to talk about. Thanks, Nicole, for taking the time out to be with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
All right. And you're listening to Flashpoints. We're going to take, you may have heard that the former president of the United States was recommended for prosecution for essentially trying to overthrow the last election, a few other things, insurrection, stuff like that. I guess they somewhere in the language they have to have the Mike Pence and the potential hanging or whatever. But we wanted to play some sounds from the hearing today that includes Liz Cheney. So listen to this.
Good afternoon, and may God bless the United States of America. To cast a vote in the United States is an act of faith and hope. When we drop that ballot in the ballot box, we expect the people named on the ballot are going to uphold their end of the deal. The winner swears an oath and upholds it. Those who come up short ultimately accept the results and abide by the rule of law. That faith in our system is the foundation of American democracy. If the faith is broken, so is our democracy. Donald Trump broke that faith. He lost the 2020 election and knew it. But he chose to try to stay in office through a multi-part scheme to overturn the results and block the transfer of power. In the end, he summoned a mob to Washington, and knowingly they were armed and angry, pointed them to the Capitol and told them to fight like hell. There's no doubt about this. This afternoon, my colleagues will present our key findings, reminding you of some of the information we presented in earlier hearings and telling you how it fits in our broader conclusions. Those conclusions have helped shape the committee's final report, which we'll adopt today pursuant to House Resolution 503, which establishes the select committee nearly a year and a half ago. I expect our final work will be filed with the clerk of the House and made public later this week. Beyond that release, the select committee intends to make public the bulk of its non-sensitive records before the end of the year. These transcripts and documents will allow the American people to see for themselves the body of evidence we've gathered and continue to explore the information that has led us to our conclusions. This committee is nearing the end of its work, but as the country, we remain in strange and uncharted waters. We've never had a president of the United States stir up a violent attempt to block the transfer of power. I believe nearly 2 years later, this is still a time of reflection and reckoning. If we are to survive as a nation of laws and democracy, this can never happen again. How do we stop it? This committee will lay out a number of recommendations in its final report. But beyond any specific details and recommendations we present, there's one factor I believe is most important in preventing another January 6th, accountability. So today, beyond our findings, we will also show that evidence we've gathered points to further action beyond the power of this committee or the Congress to help ensure accountability under law. Accountability that can only be found in the criminal justice system. We have every confidence that the work of this committee will help provide a roadmap to justice, and that the agencies and institutions responsible for ensuring justice under the law will use the information we've provided to aid in their work. And for those of you who have followed this committee's work, I hope we've helped make clear that there's a broader kind of accountability. Accountability to all of you, the American people. The future of our democracy rests in your hands. It's up to the people of this country to decide who deserves the public trust, who will put fidelity to the Constitution and democracy above all else, who will abide by the rule of law, no matter the outcome. I'm grateful to the millions of you who followed this committee's work. I hope we lived up to our commitment to present the facts and let the facts speak for themselves. Let me say in closing, the women and men seated around me on this dais are public servants in the most genuine sense. They put aside politics and partisanship to ensure the success of this committee in providing answers to the American people. I especially want to thank and acknowledge our vice chair, who has become a true partner in this bipartisan effort, Ms. Cheney of Wyoming. And I also recognize her for any opening statement that she care to offer.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for your tremendous leadership of this committee. I know we all have benefited greatly from your wisdom and your wise counsel, so thank you very much. In April of 1861, when Abraham Lincoln issued the first call for volunteers for the Union Army, my great-great-grandfather, Samuel Fletcher Cheney, joined the 21st Ohio Volunteer Infantry. He fought through all 4 years of the Civil War, from Chickamauga to Stones River to Atlanta. He marched with his unit in the Grand Review of Troops up Pennsylvania Avenue in May of 1865, past a reviewing stand where President Johnson and General Grant were seated. Silas Canfield, the regimental historian of the 21st Ohio Volunteer Infantry, described the men in the unit this way. He said they had a just appreciation of the value and advantage of free government and the necessity of defending and maintaining it. And they enlisted, prepared to accept all the necessary labors, fatigues, exposures, dangers, and even death for the unity of our nation and the perpetuity of our institutions. I have found myself thinking often, especially since January 6th, of my great-great-grandfather and all those in every generation who have sacrificed so much for the unity of our nation and the perpetuity of our institutions. At the heart of our republic is the guarantee of the peaceful transfer of power. Members of Congress are reminded of this every day as we pass through the Capitol Rotunda. There, 8 magnificent paintings detail the earliest days of our republic. One, painted by John Trumbull, depicts the moment in 1793 when George Washington resigned his commission, handing control of the Continental Army back to Congress. Trumbull called this, quote, one of the highest moral lessons ever given the world. With this noble act, George Washington established the indispensable example of the peaceful transfer of power in our nation. Standing on the west front of the Capitol in 1981, President Ronald Reagan described it this way. The orderly transfer of authority as called for in the Constitution routinely takes place, as it has for almost two centuries, and few of us stop to think how unique we really are. In the eyes of many in the world, this every four-year ceremony that we accept as normal is nothing less than a miracle. Every president in our history has defended this orderly transfer of authority, except one. January 6th, 2021 was the first time one American president refused his constitutional duty to transfer power peacefully to the next. In our work over the last 18 months, the Select Committee has recognized our obligation to do everything we can to ensure this never happens again. At the beginning of our investigation, we understood that tens of millions of Americans had been persuaded by President Trump that the 2020 election was stolen by overwhelming fraud. And we also knew this was flatly false. We knew that dozens of state and federal judges had addressed and resolved all manner of allegations about the election. Our legal system functioned as it should, but our president would not accept the outcome. Among the most shameful of this committee's findings was that President Trump sat in the dining room off the Oval Office watching the violent riot at the Capitol on television. For hours, he would not issue a public statement instructing his supporters to disperse and leave the Capitol, despite urgent pleas from his White House staff and dozens of others to do so. Members of his family, his White House lawyers, virtually all those around him knew that this simple act was critical. For hours, he would not do it. During this time, law enforcement agents were attacked and seriously injured. The Capitol was invaded, the electoral count was halted, and the lives of those in the Capitol were put at risk. In addition to being unlawful, as described in our report, this was an utter moral failure and a clear dereliction of duty. Evidence of this can be seen in the testimony of President Trump's own White House counsel and several other White House witnesses. No man who would behave that way at that moment in time can ever serve in any position of authority in our nation again. He is unfit for any office. The committee recognizes that our work has only begun. It's only the initial step in addressing President Trump's effort to remain in office illegally. Prosecutors are considering the implications of the conduct that we describe in our report, as are citizens all across our nation. In 1761, John Adams wrote, "The very ground of our liberties is the freedom of elections. Faith in our elections and the rule of law is paramount to our republic. Election deniers, those who refuse to accept lawful election results, purposely attack the rule of law and the foundation of our country. The history of our time will show that the bravery of a handful of Americans doing their duty saved us from an even more grave constitutional crisis. Elected officials, election workers, and public servants stood against Donald Trump's corrupt pressure. Many of our committee's witnesses showed selfless patriotism, and their words and courage will be remembered. The brave men and women of the Capitol Police, the Metropolitan Police, and all the other law enforcement officers who fought to defend us that day saved lives and our democracy. Finally, I wish to thank my colleagues on this committee. It has been a tremendous honor to serve with all of you. We have accomplished great and important things together, and I hope we have set an example. And I also want to thank all of those who have honorably contributed to the work of our committee and to our report. We have accomplished much over a short period of time. Many of you sacrificed for the good of our nation. You have helped make history, and I hope helped to right the ship. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I yield back.
Gentlelady yields back. As you know, this is our final meeting of our committee. Over the course of the last year and a half, we presented evidence in 10 public hearings, testimony from our brave law enforcement officers, senior White House and campaign officials, and many others. Today, we are prepared to share our findings with you. But before we do so, it's important to remember what we've learned, and critically, exactly what happened at the United States Capitol on January 6th. Without objection, I include in the record a video presentation of some of the key evidence our investigation has uncovered.
There were officers on the ground. They were bleeding. They were throwing up. I saw friends with blood all over their faces. I was slipping in people's blood.
As I was swarmed by a violent mob, they ripped off my badge. They grabbed and stripped me of my radio. They seized ammunition that was secured to my body. They began to beat me with their fists and with what felt like hard metal objects.
That wraps it up for another episode of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Senior producers are Miguel Gavilan Molina and Kevin Pina. Technical director is Mike Biggs. For previous episodes, go to kpfa.org or flashpoints.net. For questions or comments, email dennis@kpfa.org. Thank you for listening.
Samyan of Alternative Radio, and you're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO's end of your drive is happening right now. We invite you to become a member.